evening. Welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I am Dan Roth, and joining me this week is Jeff Ross.
Hey, guys.
And Mike Harley, back for more.
It is good to be back.
So, Jeff, since you haven't been on in a little while, what are you driving? What's in your garage?
I think you're personally going to love this car.
I doubt that.
No. It is the Volvo C30 Polestar.
All the torque steer your elbow joints can handle.
This thing, I'm not a huge fan of Volvos. I'll throw that out there, first of all. But I love this. And it comes in like this obnoxious blue color with matte black wheels.
What's the horsepower?
250. So it's right there with like the Speed 3 and the Focus ST.
And this is the Polestar too, so its torque is up at like, it's got like an upper limit of like 275 or something for at least a few seconds.
Overboost.
Yeah.
Like an overboost, right?
Yeah. And the color is probably called something silly like.
It's Rebel Blue.
Rebel Blue?
Yep.
Rebel, like Yeehaw Stars and Bars? Rebel?
I guess so. If that's what you want to go with.
It's more like a Smurf Blue.
Yes, it's very Smurf-tastic.
Yeah, very Smurfy.
But the Smurfs aren't Swedish. The Smurfs are...
American.
No?
Yeah, BMW had a Laguna Seca Blue that was similar.
I was driving next to a Grabber Blue Mustang, and it's a little bit different, but not too much different.
Okay, so it's that obnoxious... Well, you know what? I actually had a Volvo that was kind of that color. I called it Puff the Magic Wagon. We won't get into it, but... Yeah, it was built in Torslanda, so there you go. So anyway, about the C30, what else do you like besides the ridiculous power?
Well, I haven't driven the Focus ST, and I have driven the Speed 3, and I would put it, you know, based on what I've heard about the ST and its torque steerishness, I don't think the Volvo has that much torque steer. I mean, I got on this thing, and it was pretty good.
But, well, Volvo's been doing turbos and front-wheel drive for a long time.
And they've been doing torque steer for a long
right.
time.
But no, I'm basing this on the Speed 3 and what I've heard about the Focus ST. I know how bad the Mazda is. That thing, you can change lanes just by hitting the gas pedal. But this and the Volvo, it's really toned down. I mean, it's just... There's some, of course, because it's front-wheel drive only, but it's not anything that you have to pay attention to.
Yeah, but, I mean, first of all, is this a manual or an automatic?
Yes, it's the manual.
It's a manual, and it doesn't have that much torque steer. That's interesting.
Actually, of all my criticisms of the car... I wish it had, like, a shorter shifter. It feels like it's got a normal shifter in it. This thing would be completely awesome with a short shifter.
How's it geared? Is first gear low, or is it, you know, allow you to run it up, you know, pretty high on the tack in first and second and third?
It feels pretty low in first. I mean, I've stalled it a couple times because I was trying to take off too slow, I guess. And right. it kind of wants you to be... up there a little bit, but it's just like getting from gear to gear, there's just like the normal C30 shifter, I guess it right. would be a Volvo.
Yeah, the shifter does suck in that car, if I recall correctly. I routinely missed one shift, and I was talking with another auto writer guy up here, and I was like, do you find that you miss this shift? And he was like, you just don't know how to drive a manual. I was like, no, actually, I'm pretty good at it. I find that the shifter in this car sucks. He's like, well, if you shift too fast, I was like, all right, we are clearly two different generations of people talking at each other. So never mind. But I find the controls in the C30 sort of feel more economy car-ish. Like they don't feel like the rest of the car, where it's this beautifully designed sort of executed piece that driving it, you realize like, oh yeah, it's a Focus.
Well, in this one, it's fully decked out at $35,000.
Oh.
It's got a platinum system with navigation, but it still it feels like it has pleather seats.
Are they the what do they call it? T-Tech or something or
yeah, whatever it is. It's just not leather, but
yeah, that's a lot of money for that car.
And it's got like the afterthought navigation system that pops up from the dash, and it has the blind controllers on the back of the steering wheel that you can't see.
You know, the crazy thing is, you know, that's Volkswagen Golf R territory. And a lot of people at 35, 36 grand think the Golf R is too expensive.
Yeah, but the Golf R just, the Golf R drives so well compared to the
Yeah, it drives really, really well. I like the Golf R.
Do you like the C30?
I like the Golf R better.
Oh, yeah. That's not the question I asked. I like the Golf R better, too, and I'm a Volvo guy. But, I mean, I like the throwback hatch of the C30. I like the rarity of it.
The styling on the C30 is going to turn a lot more heads. And I hear the women really like the C30. Let's put it nicely. So,
is this car a magnet, Jeff?
I've heard it is.
I pulled up the first night I had it. I went and got some takeout, and I got out of the car before I even stepped out. People were already making fun of the color blue. And then I'm just looking around the parking lot, seeing.
So then you changed your shirt color, right?
No, like then I'm looking around the parking lot. Like this car would destroy so many cars in a drag race, or I'm guessing on a road course too. But people would. They look at it and like, oh, look at that tacky blue car. Let's just make fun of it. And then all of a sudden it leaves you behind at a light.
Wait. These are people in Florida. So they were in what, like bright red Grand Ams?
No. We drive Grand Marquis down here.
Yeah, Mercury's but those people product. Can't see anymore.
And that's one of its strengths, actually. It is a sleeper. Nobody is going to take their Volvo down to the quarter mile strip on Friday nights and race it. You know, it's one of those cars that you can just glance over at the light and it turns green and you just take off and you leave them sitting there. Yeah, it's a cool looking car.
But I've always liked the C30 and I liked it even more when they did the redesign. I guess it was in 2011, just like the new headlights.
So, yeah.
How's it ride? It looks like it's got some serious wheels.
It's only got 17-inch wheels or 18-inch. They're not that big. Yeah, they're 17s.
How is the ride, though?
Not that bad. I mean, okay. There's a road near my house, and it's got like a pothole every 5 feet, it seems like. And it can get a little bouncy over that. But I'm guessing this thing has a... You know, upgraded suspension system.
Well, the Polestar probably has the sport suspension.
Yeah.
But the last time I drove a C30, it was the version 2.0. It had all the toys, and I didn't find it objectionable. It was stiff, but it wasn't overly so. I thought it was okay. It was a decent compromise. But just generally, like, for the money, man, there's a lot of choice. There's a lot of different cars you could buy for that money.
Yeah, and I haven't priced out like how much a fully loaded Focus ST is, but even with Ford and how they've gotten out of control with their pricing, I'm guessing you cannot buy a $35,000 Focus ST.
Yeah, but you'd be hard. Yeah, you. I think you're right.
You'd be hard pressed to get up there.
Yeah, but I also think that only an idiot pays sticker for the C30 right now. Given,
but this is one of 250, so I'd be interested to see if dealers are marking this car up. Yeah,
there are no speculators. We're not going to see Barrett Jackson a C30 rolling across the stage in 20 years, going for $4.6 million. So, I just think it's a unique car for the Volvo enthusiast, and much like the Golf R is. You know, that's a guy who loves the Volkswagen brand, loves the GTI, and wants the range top and model. And I think that's the and they're going to sell all of them, obviously.
You think so? I think it's going to take them a while to sell all of them.
You think it'll sit on showrooms? Do you remember the back in 95 before both of you guys were born?
Oh, come on. I was around.
BMW had an M3 lightweight. And they
the CSL.
Give those things. Yeah, they could not give those things away.
Yeah, and now you try to sell one on eBay.
Yeah, and they're worth twice as much as the normal E36 M3s.
Yeah. And they're about half as fun to drive unless you're on a track.
Right, exactly. No air conditioning stripped out, but
yeah, which is like everybody's like, ah, well, tough guys, we like those things, and then you're like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'll take leather seats and air conditioning. Screw off. All right, so Mike, what do you have in your garage?
I went from the huge Hemi powered 300 last week to a 2013 Nissan Altima 3.5 liter with a CVT. Big buzzkill.
No, actually,
the car is nice. It's very buzzy. I was more impressed with it when it was sitting still than when I actually started it up and started driving it around. And every minute, every mile I put on it, I like it less and less. And that's probably the best way to say it. I've probably put about 500 miles on it so far over the past 7 days. And fuel economy, not very good, averaging about 25 miles per gallon. And that's about 80 or 90% highway. I just still can't swallow the CVT. It takes all the fun out of the engine. I don't know why anyone would go for the 3.5 liter with the CVT. I just stick with a four-cylinder in this car. You're paying the premium at the pump, and you're not able to really use the engine anyway. Interior is okay. It's comfortable. Seats are comfortable. The navigation screen, this one's got nav, and it's got the Nissan Connect. It's washed out in the sun half the time. Basically, when you're driving, whenever the sun's on one half of the car, it washes the screen out almost completely. It's touchscreen. In its defense, it doesn't show a lot of fingerprints, but it sticks out of the dash far enough that it catches the rays just about all the time. Let's see. It's not an engaging car.
Yeah, I found that too about the Altima. It was like, oh, this should be great, but it's not.
Yeah, another interesting thing is it drives, and I'm trying to figure out how to say this in my story, is it drives like an old-fashioned front-wheel drive car.
Yep.
It drives like every single thing. Now, remember, this is the big engine, so it's got a lot of weight up on the nose, but it just drives like everything's up front, and the back wheels are following it around. And when you're driving, you visualize that the back wheels are like a wheelbarrow. They're just following the fronts. And a lot of today's front-wheel drive cars don't act like that anymore. They've gotten really good with balancing the powertrain and stuff. This thing just always reminds you you're in a front-wheel drive car, and it drives me nuts.
So it makes you feel like you're driving like your grandfather's celebrity around or something? It
makes me feel like I'm driving an Altima.
Don't knock the celebrity.
What's the matter with the celebrity? Okay, the celebrity was the best front-wheel drive GM car from the 80s. That's like saying like it's the best kind of herpes to have.
But the worst part is everybody knew you had a celebrity.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't find it. I mean, are there any redeeming features of the Altima that you actually find you like?
The seats are comfortable. It's got a decent sized trunk. People in the backseat passengers seem to like it. Let's see.
The backseat passenger. Are these the Harley children?
Yeah, the kids, and I've put a couple of adults back there. I ran a bunch of people down to the airport in it, and nobody complained.
So it was like a rental taxi.
You know what reminds me, and I hate to say it, reminds me a lot of a rental car. It just
because it is a rental car.
There's no passion driving it, and it just kills.
Which so I get I found that crazy.
Tomorrow. Yeah, and I'm excited about getting the Cadillac ATS tomorrow, just to get rid of the Altima. But
what kind of ATS are you getting? Are you going to get the ATS with like the Malibu 2.5 or
3.6?
Oh, well, so. the best kind of ATS. Yeah, I was actually surprised that I've normally found that Altimas have a lot more verve than some of the competitors, but the Camry I find the Camry is far more engaging to drive than the Altima.
The new Camry is really, really good. And the new Corda is excellent.
The new Corda is fantastic, yeah.
And now the one, maybe the redeeming fact, this thing is, I think, 31 grand loaded to the gills. And it does have a lot of equipment. It's got the blind spot stuff. It's got the backup camera with a wide view. It's got the lane departure warning, which drives me nuts on all Nissans. But, it does have a lot of equipment. Heated seats. Like I said, it's got the nav. The one cool thing, the Google, you can go directly online to Google and send the address directly to the vehicle, which is nice. The Google connected. So
Yeah, that, and there are other automakers that are doing that.
Right.
Toyota's doing it now. I think actually Chevrolet or GM is doing it with their OnStar stuff too. So and that's a really good idea. And I know Ford does it too. You can send directions directly to the vehicle. So
no, it's really, really convenient.
Have you used it?
Yeah, I've used it a lot.
See, I wonder, can you do something like if you want to take a specific route, can you build your route on Google Maps and then have it automatically
load?
Not that I know of.
I thought you could send a route to the car.
I've only been able to send an address. I haven't tried route. Maybe I'll try it before I give the car back.
Like if you put in different waypoints, and if you want to go a certain route that a navigation usually wouldn't take you, that's one thing I've always wondered about that system.
I've been having pissing matches with the nav system in this car because it keeps telling me it doesn't want to do certain things while I'm driving. So this, the warning comes up and won't go away. So basically it comes up on the screen and says, you can't do that, in so many words, while you're driving. And I want to hit it and say, okay, I get it. And it just leaves it up on the screen so I can't see the road. And I don't think that's very cool. You know, slap me once, but let me continue driving the car.
Yeah, well, the other thing I find about some nav systems, and I don't know if Nissan does this, I distinctly remember a Subaru system was the latest one that's done this. It's just like they incessantly – if you – some will be really good. They'll recalculate and they'll figure out your route. Others will just continue to try to get you to take a U-turn. And you're like, no, I am not going that way. Stop it.
This does that. It gets way too intrusive. Yeah. And, hey, there's traffic ahead. I've recalculated a route for you. And you could tell to ignore, but a minute later, it's like one of those kids that just didn't hear it the first time. It comes back, hey, there's traffic ahead.
Oh, yeah. And the Nissan system's the one, too, that's like, there's a weather alert 50 miles from your location.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not helpful. Die. Nissan and
there's a gale warning 50 knots offshore.
Yeah, that's true.
I had that.
Yeah, I got the gale warning. I was like, "What? We're not in New Bedford. We don't go."
That's what my wife said. What's a gale? Seas are 3 to 5 feet.
Yeah, don't worry. It's one flag. It's the red square and the black,
and the grunions are running.
The grunions, excellent. Aren't they? That's a springtime thing. But all right, so we pretty much exhausted. We're talking about fish spawning in California, so I think we've said all there is to say about the.
Anyway, bottom line is, if you're going to buy an Altima, go for the 4-cylinder engine. Realize what you're getting into and enjoy it. Just don't go for the 3.5. Encourage them.
No, and return it to Enterprise when you're done with it. Two days later, because that car just feels like a rental to me.
Yeah.
And so. Gracing my driveway for the last week was the Dodge Journey RT all-wheel drive. And as a family guy, I'm very impressed with this as a family vehicle. I think it's a fantastic family vehicle, which I find really strange to be saying because it's based on the Mitsubishi GS, which means it shares a lot with the Patriot and the Compass and the 200/Sebring. But you drive the Journey and you're like, you know, this should be so much more horrible than it is given what I know about it. And it's not. And maybe that's partly because it had the Uconnect system with the DVD screen in it and everything was really easy to use. And it had the Pentastar, which surprisingly gets shockingly bad mileage in this vehicle. But
what kind of fuel economy?
Like 20.
Jeez.
Part of that might be that I was using the remote start.
letting it idle for 35 minutes.
No, it'll shut itself off, but 20's not good. 20, and I saw teens on the display a lot. So, yeah, but it does have three rows. I mean, the third row is sort of like a occasional seat.
What does the rest of the family think of it?
My kids loved it because they watched Cars over and over and over again, and it was blissfully silent. But my wife picked up on something that I also picked up on with it was it feels bouncy in that, you know, like the suspension is calibrated to sort of – it just feels like there's a lot of spring travel, you know, and it just sort of feels like it's – they've done a pretty good job with it, but that's probably part of what's left over from the underlying platform. Because you know, you can look under hood and see that there is a strut tower brace that goes across the firewall and stuff. So they've done their best to really solidify what they've got, and it's pretty quiet and tight, but it does feel a little sort of bouncy and almost like half trucky. So you know, other than that, it's really functional. But given the, this is like 30, I think it was stickered out at like 33, 34. And I was thinking about this. So for $34,000, you can get the pretty fully loaded Journey. But I think only, again, only a schmuck buys a Journey that's that expensive and pays sticker.
Can we quote you on that?
Yeah.
It's a good tagline.
Only a schmuck buys this sport car. But then again, like a Ford Edge with all that stuff, it, you know, to match what this had, Uconnect and the screens and the three rows of seats, which you can't get in an Edge. But so it had all the toys and all wheel drive. A Ford Edge equipped like that is going to be like 40, if not more. And it's going to have my Ford Touch, which you're just going to want to bludgeon to death. And so, you know, and the interior materials are nicer in the Journey. The Journey arguably is not unpleasant to drive. And so, really, who's the schmuck if you opt for the Ford? I think you're the schmuck if you opt for the Ford, because you get, like, chintzy plastic door panels still. And I don't know. But... I'm like impressed with it as a family person, family guy. I'm not terribly impressed with it as a car enthusiast. So it's sort of like those throwaway family wagons.
But I think you nailed it right there. For the family guy, this thing is ideal. No enthusiast is ever going to walk in and say, I've been saving up for the Journey. it's not a good autocross truck.
Nope.
And, you know, there are just certain things that just doesn't do well. And, but for your family people, you know, the guy wants a little bit of a truck, needs all-wheel drive, wants the third row. But like you said, it starts, I think I'm on the website right now, it starts at $19,500.
Right. No, and I mean, it is
$15,000 of the options on it. You are a little loony.
Yeah. So. But it's loaded. And it's all this stuff is really easy to use. Chrysler nails it with ergonomics. Uconnect even works with gloves, the touchscreen. I was wearing gloves this morning, and I was using the touchscreen, and it was great.
Still drive white gloves?
No. I was wearing it was cold up here. It was like 20.
Mittens, right?
Yeah, but it works. Like, you can't do that with my Ford Touch. The icons are too small, and the screen just won't work. Uconnect, it works, which I thought was pretty great. I was very impressed with that. So, functionally, you know, in the places that matter to most people, the thing kills. It's great. The places where I see criticism are like, okay, I know what it's based on. There are places where, like, you know how in the old minivans, like the Caravan, when they redesigned it in 2008, everybody's like, well, it's got a lot of features, but when you look at how it's put together, kind of pales in comparison to the Honda and the Toyota. That's kind of the same way that the Journey is. Like, there are places where you can just see some of the money savings, you know, like the panels and back and stuff. They're very flexible to the touch.
They're cardboard.
Yeah. I mean, but again, it, you know, for what it is, I like the Journey. And I find myself surprised saying that, because I don't really dig even the Patriot, which is sort of the most acceptable other thing I would find on this platform. I just don't like, but the Journey I like. I do think that the transmission is programmed to hop into sixth gear a little too quick, but
it's a common complaint across just about a lot of automakers these days, though.
Yeah.
They're all seeking fuel economy,
and this has none. I saw teens, I tell you, and the Durango. It's not that far off of a Durango at that point. You can get a Durango for $33,000. It'll be like a crew, but it'll have a bunch of stuff. And so it may not be quite as fully loaded, but it's a Durango. and it's going to drive better. So
yeah, Durango starts at 29.4.
Yeah, but a Durango crew is right in there, like 32.
Yeah, 34.8 on a crew.
Durango's so much bigger, though, too.
Yeah, and it also gets bad fuel economy. But it's so much more delightful to drive. But if you want stuff and three rows and manageable size, this is your car.
But would you say for people to step up to the Durango for a little more money?
I would seriously consider hopping into the Durango. The thing that would sort of occupy my thoughts is, okay, this is the car that you buy so that the kids can have the space they need and just completely thrash it.
Right.
Not really care, you know? And then you throw it away. It's disposable. And in the meantime, it's decent enough, you know? Whereas the Durango, I want the Durango just because I love it, because it drives really well and it connects to me as an enthusiast. So that would hurt a lot more to see it all gouged up and dinged. Where the Journey seems to like deserve it.
So get the Journey with the plastic interior.
Yeah, and there's no Hemi available in the Journey, which I think everything should have Hemis. Hemis for everyone. My Hemi democratizer. But yeah, so there we go. Three relatively not exciting cars this week. And we should move on. So, speaking of relatively not exciting cars, we had the Detroit show, but it turns out that there was some stuff going on in Canada, such as, and we'll bookend the rest of the podcast with Canada. So, our first Canada item is the Mitsubishi Mirage that actually turned up in Montreal with no name, and Mitsubishi says they're going to sell it in Canada with 74 horsepower. I don't know. You guys think this has any hopes of coming to the States?
I'd say no.
I could see them selling it here. Maybe not with that engine, but...
Because we haven't seen anything from Mitsubishi.
Yeah, last thing we saw was the Outlander Sport, I guess in the eye. But I think they really need a high-volume car. And if they undercut the Versa with this, then... You know, it's not aimed at enthusiasts. It's going to be a budget car.
Yeah, but look at the, Mitsubishi is on a lot of people's death watch right now. And they need a home run, not another tiny, subcompact with little 12-inch pizza cutter looking wheels. They may bring it here, but I don't think it's going to sell well.
Well, this thing definitely looks like it was made in the late 90s.
I was going to say, yeah. it looks old and it looks anonymous. As much as they talk about its fun, sporty styling, I'm not seeing it. I don't think that Mitsubishi's going to really like file for Chapter 11 or anything. I mean, they're tied to, what is it in Japan, the big investment group, Security?
No. They are a huge company. What I'm saying is, how much longer are they going to be selling in the States?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they don't really have any... They don't have any production facilities in the States to speak of, so
right.
It gets to be a much harder proposition, especially with what's going on economically in Japan, where things are sort of whipsawing and our world currency is sort of doing crazy things. So I don't know how much sense it makes for them to.
Well, they make the Outlander Sport here still.
Yeah, I know, but they don't really have much of a presence. And how flexible is their presence?
Right.
Could they make this thing on the same line? And that would be a question for Mitsubishi, I suppose. I could see them trying it with a different engine. It could compete with the Prius. Not the Prius, the Yaris. Listen to me.
I'm skeptical.
I think this is just... I mean, if they did build it here, it's going to be like a like I said, a budget thing. And it's going to be, against the Hyundai Accent and the Chevy Spark and stuff like that. Really small cars with not a lot to offer. And I guess the Spark does offer a lot, but this won't.
The Spark offers that crazy pink color.
No. Spark offers my link. That's something.
That's not much. Can't you get? I don't know. So you don't think Mitsubishi's going to have something?
No, this probably doesn't even have a hood prop.
This thing is ugly.
You guys,
it's just period. It's ugly.
Okay.
It won't sell because remember, you know, okay, at this end of the car buying consumer, you know, first of all, I argue from day one that, you know, car buying is an emotional thing. It's an emotional purchase. And, you know, emotions push the people to buy the $35,000 car when they wanted to buy the $30,000 car. But there's no emotional appeal. So the only thing that's going to drive sales of this thing would be price. They have to give it away. And it would have to have pretty extraordinary fuel economy at the same time. And, you know, you're competing with, like you said, you know, the Mazda 2 and some other cars that, you know, are pretty well established. So.
But, and the Mazda 2 is not that advanced, so it wouldn't take much to steal a couple sales away from it. But,
yeah, but Jeff,
this,
what are you gonna
this would either have to have like a $9,000 sales price or get like 45 miles per gallon.
Okay, Jeff, and I don't
know both.
Jeff, sight unseen, you haven't driven, you know, you haven't driven this thing. What are you going to take, the Mazda 2 or this thing?
Mazda 2, Mazda 2. In the same okay. color.
There we go. Now, Chevy Spark or this thing?
Chevy Spark.
Chevy Spark, okay. Hyundai Accent, you know, 10-year warranty or this, thing?
This thing. Because this thing also offers a 10-year, 160,000 kilometer. I don't know what that equates to, but I think it's 100,000 miles.
I think it is.
Warranty. And I don't like the accent.
Make mine in black so it's invisible.
I don't know.
And I'm going to spray paint the wheels black, too.
But, I mean, for $9,000...
Like, and the windshield, too, so no one can see me.
This is what you do for $9,000? This is... I don't know. I think that there is a need in the market for vehicles like this. I don't think that it's as big as people think it is. And by people,
there
is
a need in the market,
companies,
but not on U.S. roads. There are big trucks on U.S. roads.
Yeah. Well, the other problem is used cars.
Right.
For $9,000, you can buy a lot of car. So, all right. So we'll look at it in Canada, and maybe, you know, maybe it'll play up there because they have other stuff too. Like they get the Orlando up there, which we don't get here. Although we have the state with the city.
The what?
The Orlando.
He's talking about Florida.
Yes.
Oh. That was a plug. There's a plug in the background somewhere.
They stole our state's names.
Yeah, but that's a product that we all were like, oh, that'd be awesome. And then it turns out that it's not so awesome because we had our guy in Canada check it out. He was not super impressed. So maybe this will be one of those things that Mitsubishi wants to get into the North American market, and they think that the people that will buy them are in Canada. And maybe they can make a profit for it there. I have a feeling it wouldn't do too well here. But what do I know?
I agree with you. And I think it's funny. I'm looking at the on the picture on our website, and it's rare that you see pictures of cars, like model, you know, modeling cars, and you could see the lead wheel weights on the outside of the wheels at the same time. So well, that's just a little pet peeve of mine. If you're going to photograph, if you know, if they hire you to bring a car into a studio and photograph it, rip the wheel weights off.
So when you drive it out of the studio, it vibrates.
I don't. It's not your problem. You're the photographer, remember?
So that's why none of the LA cars have wheel weights on them.
Like Harley's gotten out of.
I'm not ripping wheel weights off yet.
So we'll go from something that's probably going to be unsuccessful in this market if it ever comes to something that's been hugely successful, and that is Toyota. The word is that Toyota. Might build all of the models they sell here, right here. That's according to Bill Fay, who is vice president and general manager of Toyota. You know, Jeff, I mean, do you think that makes sense for them to build the stuff for this market? I mean, do they lose anything by doing that? Because clearly, one of the big things about Toyota is quality, and one of the big knocks on American automakers based here in America is quality.
I don't think the quality is going to suffer. I mean, all the Toyota products that are built here right now don't have major quality issues as opposed to what's coming from Japan. But yeah, it does seem interesting because all these automakers are starting to clump together. I mean, before, you know, the U.S. was being outsourced away from, now we're all being insourced. So I guess it's good for our economy.
I think it's a really, really good idea. I think the quality issues, if you look back to the 80s when everybody thought the cars from Japan were good and the cars from America were pieces of trash, the Japanese automakers started building plants over here, and they were able to prove that it wasn't the assembly that was building bad cars. The Hondas built in America were every bit as good as the Hondas built in Japan. It was the design of the vehicles themselves.
Well, so, it was also.
I don't think it's a quality issue.
I don't think it is. I think probably what it is a price thing. I don't think that they can continue to sell these.
Oh, obviously.
Yeah, these cars in this market without building them here, and I think what we're actually seeing is the sort of the final chapter of the master plan of Toyota in the way that they set up their production system, where they've got the suppliers all located very close, and they do just in time versus huge inventories of parts and stuff.
Obviously this is 100% a financial decision. It's not just being able to bring your cars from the manufacturing facility to the showroom quicker, but you avoid the tariffs, the taxes, the transport, all those costs. The Germans, everybody's doing it. I bet 20 years from now it'll be very, very unlikely to buy a European car, a Japanese car, or a Chinese car, or a Korean car that's not made domestically. So,
well, I think that's one of the things that Toyota pioneered was the way to build cars, build a mix of vehicles very efficiently on the same line with very few defects, and just consistently get the price of the cars down. So I think this is the ultimate expression of that, where they've moved from building their highest volume cars to now looking to sell everything they sell here built here. So
see, and what I was most interested about this, because I mean this probably spells the end for like the Land Cruiser and the FJ Cruiser. The easiest thing to do rather than build them here is just get rid of them. But the Yaris and the Prius, I don't see those going anywhere anytime soon. So,
There's so much profit in a Land Cruiser for those guys. They can afford, what do they only sell, like a few hundred a year anyway? They'll bring them in. They'll import them.
Yeah. I mean, they'll import the stuff that makes sense, but certainly they're going to bring the Prius here because Prius production here is going to eventually be more nimble, cheaper. And I think, honestly, going to be a good thing for us the same way the cars that are already here have been a good thing for our domestic brands and jobs. It's going to raise the quality of suppliers, and suppliers don't work with just one manufacturer, and so they're going to, it's going to raise the quality and sort of bring that technology over here domestically produced for anybody who's willing to buy it. So I think that's going to be good.
It's really good.
I would be curious to see which Chinese company winds up here first, building cars. And I wonder if that's sort of the way to crack the market instead of sending cars from China over here to build a plant here. But who knows? Speaking of transplants, Hyundai looks like they're kind of bailing out the Nürburgring. And maybe they're looking for more credibility by doing this. Maybe they'll finally figure out how to build a car with that ride and handling balance that pleases me, because I know that they're working hard on making Dan Roth not complain.
That's their number one priority.
It should be, damn it. So they're looking to build a 10,000 square foot test center at the Nürburgring. What's up with that?
Oh, I would, I've been over there an awful lot of times, and there are a lot of automakers that have test facilities adjacent to the Nürburgring, right across the street, literally. They've got warehouses and shops, and they've set up security and things like that. I want to know if these guys are actually on the facility of the ring, or are they just going to be across the street like most of the automakers are? Because they're across the street, I don't see how they're helping to bail the place out. If they're on site, the $7.3 million facility obviously will help the place, but...
Well, I think if they're on site, they're going to be renting time, right?
Yeah, everybody's renting time, right?
But still, I mean, BMW has the facility right there. Mm-hmm. BMW probably tests all of their cars on the ring. How many Hyundais, I'm guessing, would get tested there? I mean, I don't see them running the Accent or the Azera around the track for high-performance handling.
They should.
Yeah, I think every vehicle would benefit running around the ring, because it does, it is a unique environment. It's a long road, and it's basically the automotive world now considers it the ultimate test track.
Yeah, but we should go into that, because you've been there. Why? It's track. In Germany.
It's a track. It's a track in Germany. It's a very long track, but it's a... I'm not familiar with your neighborhood, but imagine a track that leaves your front door and runs over past the mall and then goes by your school and then runs past the 7-Eleven and then heads back, by your parents' house and then back to your house again. It is a huge track. It has different climate zones. You're going through one part and it's sunny and warm, and then, a few minutes later you're coming over a crest and it's raining and cold. The track varies in width. It varies as far as the surface. Some is asphalt, some is paved concrete. There are high speed bumps and ruts and off camber and on camber turns. It's what the automakers have been building, the Dearborn test facility. What they do is they build little stretches of pavement and they build all the little corners on site. This is the Nürburgring has it there for them in the first place. And if they can master the bump on turn 72 that, Porsche can master with their Azera, I think they figure they've got it figured out.
But then the advertisement for the Azera is going to be handles like a 911.
Let them.
Outbreaks a Ferrari.
It's good for everybody. This is good news, guys. This is good news.
Well, yeah.
Think of it here. Okay, let's do it this way. Think of it as a standardized test. Instead of every automaker running their own silly test track on their own silly facility, now we have a standardized test. Everybody's testing their vehicles at Nürburgring. Everybody, and it's got all the right dips. It's got all the right bumps. It's got all the right whoop-de-doos. And it's a standardized test. So maybe now, for you guys, Hyundai could finally figure out suspension tuning.
I don't know, though, because, they already have... I wonder if it's going to do anything, because their cars probably already handle okay on the track. They probably do master that bump at turn 72 in some of them.
73.
But they, yes. But they ride like crap on the road, because they do. So I don't know. It makes me curious to see whether a Nürburgring tuned Sonata is going to be better than the current wherever they tuned it Sonata.
I would say it won't.
Your optimism.
I think Hyundai just wants to see their name on the same sentence as Nürburgring.
Yeah, well, and I think part of it too is like numbers jockeys, will eventually come up with something where they're like, because everybody does it from time to time. Like, our car outdoes a Ferrari in this, and in trunk space, big deal. Like, whatever. Hyundai's aggressive, and if they manage to fix their suspensions, I think they'll pretty much have a complete package there, because that's really like the last thing that's sort of missing for me is the actual driving of the car. All the parts are there, but they just don't tend to work in harmony.
But you touched on something a second ago. You said Hyundai is aggressive, and they do not sleep, apparently. They are doing, one side of them, we hear they're going to come out with a four-door coupe. Another side, someone's saying we're going to go test the Nürburgring. The other guys are talking about bringing back CVTs at Hyundai, launching CVTs. And, the good thing is they're pushing hard, and we like that as enthusiasts. We like automakers that don't just sit back and rest on their laurels.
Yeah. Yeah, so when they come out with the four-door coupe with a CVT that they drove on the Nürburgring for disappointing results, we'll send it right to you, and you can talk it up, all right?
I don't ever want to see another CVT again. I hate CVT. For the record, I don't like CVT.
All right, well, okay, so what about, like an Alfa Romeo that's tuned on the ring? Because they're supposedly coming. That's what Sergio Marchionne says, anyway, that they're... sometime this year, which is what they said last year, I thought, we're going to see Alphas coming back. So, maybe there'll be another European car that we can all talk about buying and not actually buy.
Crickets.
My cat says yes. Yes, sir, says my cat.
I would like to see Alpha back.
Why?
It's something different. I like variety, and not to say I'm going to buy it, but I like mixing things up. I like competition, and the big question is, what are they going to bring to the table?
Well, apparently they're going to make sure that they have the Italian engines. They're not going to be using the engines that are in the Dart, although those are apparently Italian engines. Aren't those the Tiger Sharks and stuff?
I'm not sure.
Jeff Ross knows.
I do not know.
Oh. You disappoint me.
We were counting on you.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I go back and forth. I mean, I think, honestly, the first Alpha we're going to see is a Miata. That's probably the first thing we're going to see is the little joint venture that they do with Mazda.
The little 4C thing?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be the 4C or is it going to be the no, joint?
It's going to be much smaller than a 4C. They're saying it's going to be the same size as the Miata, but with its own engines and own design. But I agree, it probably will be the first Alpha we see back here.
Yeah, is that joint thing that they've talked about? What are they going to call it? Is it like a...
They haven't announced anything yet.
What's the Rush song? Barchetta, right? Red Barchetta? Nobody listens to Rush.
Tom Sawyer.
Canadian rock. That's kind of like listening to Geometry. Okay. Giddy Lee is going to write in and be like, you guys suck.
I like Rush.
I like old Rush. They have a sense of humor, I will say that. They took lessons actually to learn how to loosen up. I don't think it really worked, but whatever. I don't know that we're going to see Alpha before Mazda actually brings us an Alpha first. But the other stuff that they're going to bring over is they've got the Dart GT now, which has a bit more power, and that should help them out because it seems like they admitted that the launch didn't go as well as they had thought it could have gone, and part of that might be the powertrain.
When they launched it, it had different phases. I mean, you couldn't get all the engines and transmissions right at the front. And they're still talking about the SRT4.
Well, so, they're sort of talking about that. We talked to Ralph Gillen, and he was like, "Yeah, don't talk to me about that." the Dart. I don't know. They did a very GM launch with that, didn't they? They were like, "Oh, it's gonna be great," but here right now is this one that's not as great as it could be. So buy this one because we need to sell these before we can sell you the one that's great. That's not here yet, but it's great, and it's going to be here. It was very.
And they will all have WAP engines.
Yeah, and they'll all come in through Ellis Island. I like the Dart, and I think that a Dart with a little bit more torque is fine. Although I really enjoy driving the current Dart, so whatever. We need more of that car because I like that car. And
it's going to get a 9-speed automatic.
Yeah.
Okay. Pretty soon they'll have a 10-speed car, and they'll just have to get those like rounded handlebars for a steering wheel.
The ones
and a bell, a little bell.
Yep. Did you have a bell on your 10-speed?
I had a horn.
The horn. All right.
I had a horn.
Did it play Dixie or something? Was it like a...
He went jump and stuff.
Yeah. The only other thing that we're not sure of is, like, are we going to have a Chrysler minivan, or is it going to be a Dodge, or what's going to happen with that? And I don't know, and neither do they. So who knows? Like, it's been, oh, Dodge is getting it, and then it was, oh, Chrysler's getting it, and it's going to be a Fiat van, and yeah, I don't know.
I definitely like this step, though. I mean, Chrysler's definitely getting away from the twin mobiles, so I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
But the twin mobiles meaning?
I mean, everything they have was a duplicate, like the Avenger and 200, the Town and Country and Grand Caravan. Like, pretty much everything in their lineup had a direct alternate on another platform, or just another brand. So this is kind of going, I don't know, like, towards maybe a foreign automaker, how they would work, and taking two cars that are very similar and making them nothing alike.
Yeah, well,
I mean, if they make the Town and Country a crossover, and then the Grand Caravan a minivan, then you walk into a Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Fiat, Ram, everything dealership.
SRT, don't forget SRT.
And you have this choice now. You're no longer looking at the same minivan. You're looking at two different vehicles. So I see that being a really good thing.
Oh, I don't think it's necessarily bad. It's just, I wish they'd get their act together and figure it out so we can get excited or continue to scratch our heads, because that's all we're doing right now is we're just puzzling over what's going to show up, because we don't know.
You're that concerned about minivans?
I'm not the least bit.
What's better than a good van?
No, the problem is the minivan is the ultimate family vehicle. Yeah. I just refuse to accept that.
But the minivan is no longer mini.
No, they're big now.
Like, I grew up.
You can't call them maxi vans.
Why? That's a Dodge. That's a Dodge name.
Yeah, it just sounds like it belongs in a
different. Yeah, exactly. Sort of like an iPad, right?
Yeah. Let's just leave that alone. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like, what would a European van do for them in the States, though? Like, what does Fiat have? Don't they have the Doblo, the Ducata? I don't know. They have,
I don't know,
a few different things.
All those are probably going to come in the Ram commercial brand.
Commercial brand, yeah, because they're funky. And like, if you try to port a Euro van into an American product, you end up with the Eurovan, which I didn't mean to do, but like, that was a van that they tried to sell to families here that was designed for plumbers in Germany, and it doesn't work. You create this thing that's like not quite practical. It gets its teeth kicked in by the competition that's offering more space, more features for less money, and oh, it also happens to not break as often as that fancy European thing. So I don't know. It'll be halfway interesting to watch if you care at all about vans, which nobody does. So
nope.
I'll let you guys know as I watch the proceedings what happens. But I'm pretty sure you guys will be watching trucks, and I think we just saw the next F-150 in the Ford Atlas concept. Maybe not. I don't know. I can picture these sitting in traffic where you are, Mike, and terrorizing the old ladies where you are, Jeff.
I think it's pretty cool looking.
I think it's great looking.
I think it's really, really aggressive. It's manly. It's badass.
See, I think that Ford always, you know, they try and throw us off with their concepts. I would actually see this being the next Super Duty, maybe.
I wouldn't be surprised if they held out to make it the Super Duty, but then what's the actual F-150?
I mean,
or F-Series.
They just came out with the F-150, and the Super Duty is the one that is up for redesign next. So this has more of like a big truck, throw on some dually wheels in the back.
the big tall hood and everything like that. It's got that Super Duty look to it.
I mean, just everything about it. They try and sell it as a work truck with that divoted roof and the ladder rack and the tailgate.
I mean, all of these are good points.
I mean, it's a mean looking truck. It's awesome looking.
And the interior looks like it's a place where you get hurt or you could carry out surgery. It looks like it's made out of like operating room machinery.
Did you see the transmission lever? That thing just seriously mean looking. It's that's Transformer, Terminator equipment.
You know what? It reminded me of a giant cigar cutter.
Yeah. I can see that.
Not that I have one or use one.
It does. It looks like you want to put a finger in there and just slam it down. It chops the fingers right off. It's pretty cool.
That's not where I went with it, but... I like it. What goes on in your head, Mike? It looks like you just
a family show.
Let's just keep it safe. But it does have a bunch of stuff that they're talking up beyond the styling. I mean, the first thing we notice is the styling, and it definitely says Ford truck to me. But also, there's all those. I think Ford doesn't want to let anybody else have any part of the conversation, right? So we just saw the new GM trucks, and now Ford's like, oh, we've got something too. So I wonder how quickly it came together, because they're not really sharing any details, but also they're like, oh, but it has dynamic hitch assist where it'll back itself up to a trailer for you. And the tailgate step thing that works as the cargo ladder rack cradle business. I guarantee you that the next generation EcoBoost thing that they're talking about is not under the hood of this truck. It's in development, but it's not in this truck.
Well, this thing, it probably doesn't have anything under the hood.
Yeah, probably. But I just don't think that engine's ready. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. They won't talk about future products, though.
You guys have the pictures nearby? Are you guys looking at
the Atlas?
It?
Yeah.
Yeah, the interior picture. Does it have a flat top steering wheel?
I don't know.
A lot of times you see flat bottom steering wheels on Europeans. But it's interesting if the truck decides, you know, hey, let's chop the top off also to increase outward visibility. Kind of a cool idea.
So, do you think it really works?
I don't know. It may.
I mean, outward visibility. Yeah, I do see that. The interior on this, I think, just looks so concept-y to me, and I know that it's
very concept-y, right?
The general shapes and everything are probably correct. I'm certain the materials are going to be different, and there's that enormous center console.
And we don't have a clean overview shot of the cockpit either.
Thanks a lot, Drew.
Yeah, I'm going to call Drew up right now. Have him go
out actually,
there.
Now that you point out the steering wheel, it kind of looks like a Camaro steering wheel.
Ooh, that's a low blow.
It just looks like it's so deep with such a big...
giant pad in the middle. That's the integrated pillow for work.
That's the go-kart assist.
that's where you rest. Yeah.
That's the nap pillow.
Seriously, like, okay... Here's my F-150 story for the week, which I don't actually tell F-150 stories every week, but here's one. The house across the street is having siding done, and they've been having siding done for quite a while. And first of all, it's very cold here, so it's kind of dumb to put siding on your house right now just because it's cold, and who wants to work in those conditions? But there's been an F-150 parked across the street. I swear, every time I look out, I was home yesterday because it was a holiday. Every time I looked out, the two guys were sitting in the truck. I was like, no wonder why the siding's been taking so long, because they just sit in the truck all day. So that's why I think that's the pillow where they can take the nap in the center of the steering wheel there. Maybe not. I don't know.
It's the optional nap package.
Yeah. We'll charge you an extra $500 for that. And like the XM channel that only plays lullabies. I don't know. So the efficiency stuff is cool, though, and I think we'll see that over on all Ford trucks. I don't know. What do you think about that, Mike?
Yes.
Way to go in depth. All right.
No, I think anything, you know, one complaint of full-size trucks is they drink fuel. And anything to help improve fuel economy is going to be welcome.
Yeah, the car geek in me says this is a bunch of stuff to break, but it's also, I'm sure it's going to work. You know, they've got active shutters for the wheel shutters and a chin spoiler that lowers itself. And
I think it's all brilliant. I mean, you've seen the drag coefficient. You know, you never hear rarely hear drag coefficient of trucks. SUVs, nowadays you're starting to hear this. What, 0.34 is pretty good for an SUV. 0.35, 0.36 is more on the average. But these big full-size trucks, I mean, horrible fuel, horrible aerodynamics. And,
Also, the drag coefficient is just one thing. The frontal area means more. So that's,
right.
You know, that's the drag coefficient plus the actual.
You're not going to really help your frontal area with.
That's what I'm saying is that the trucks have that giant, like, it's a belt buckle competition, right? So they just want to have the more offensive grill. Which just continues to increase the frontal area. I bet that they're almost doubled from the like late '90s F-150 that was very
easy. But things like active wheel shutters and a smart chin spoiler, you know, that's going to help throw that wall of door of an air that you're moving around the sides, which is the goal here. You don't want to feed it inside of the engine compartment where it just swirls around and acts like a parachute.
Yeah. So I think that's all. Good. I doubt that it's going to get them to like 30 miles to the gallon.
No.
But it might get them to 25.
Well, no, probably 26.
26.
Since Ram's already at 25, Ford's going to go 26.
Okay. We should do an over-under. We should do like a pool and see like what.
They're even going to have like a sail feature. So when you're doing 80 miles an hour, a mast comes up and catches the tailwind.
I got a question for you guys. Does the current F-150 have start-stop?
No, I don't believe it does.
Is that two nose?
That is two nose. This is not. This is going to have start-stop, though.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the workers and the construction guys like start-stop. I mean, you know, out on a hot day, they run their air conditioning all day long. It's not their gas bill. And they go out and the car is turned off. So it'll be interesting.
Do they do that out there?
When it's hot.
Really?
Maybe not all day.
What the hell are they thinking?
It's such a waste of fossil fuel.
That just doesn't make any sense to me. There's a whole lot of things in this life that don't make very much sense to me. And here's another thing that doesn't make any sense. The Honda Gear. Also, in Montreal, I wish they made this car and sold it here now.
Just really?
Yes.
For some reason, why this car reminds me of.
But this is the exact opposite of the Mitsubishi Mirage thing. This thing's cool looking, futuristic. I like it.
Jeff Ross doesn't like it. Why don't you like it, Jeff?
It reminds me of Liam Neeson.
What?
I don't know. Something about this car, the first time I saw it, because he's got a big forehead.
Why don't you like Liam Neeson?
I don't not like Liam Neeson. I wouldn't want to drive him.
But he's a badass in all those movies.
Don't even go there.
Yeah.
Hey, he's only a badass in like...
Taken?
Yeah, but Taken 2? That's like a... I don't know.
If Taken 1 made money, Taken 2 should
make a lot of money.
Yeah, make more money. It just looks like a Honda to me.
You're right, Michael. This is the complete opposite of the Mirage. So, I mean, there's that.
Well, my first brand new car was a 1990 Honda Civic Si hatchback. And, you know, here we are 25, 30 years later, and this thing, you know, unmistakable Honda again. Especially the rear three-quarter view. That's what I like.
The shunk. it does look like a Honda. Like, you can see all the way back to, like, the N600 in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's cool. All of the other details probably ruin it for me, because it's probably got, like, IMA and all of the other things that I hate about it. some of the current Hondas. But I, as a design study, I think it's fantastic. And
yeah, I think it's cool how the angle of the hood continues right up over the windshield. You know, it's just that you could, you know, lay a straight edge across it almost. That's cool.
Yeah. And it's so, I mean, it is clearly, it's just a design exercise, because they talk about silly things like it's inspired by fixed gear bicycles, and you're like, what? But whatever. you know, and it's just a subcompact car that's supposed to be fun and zippy and all of those things. So it probably stands no chance at getting produced. But it's also just a, it's a Honda in the Honda idiom that I wish we would see more of, which is just sort of that clean, slick design that has a definite personality. So
yeah, obviously Drew didn't take these pictures, but I'm trying to see the exhaust pipe or pipes.
There may not be one.
Yeah, well, look in that one picture, the rear three quarter, and you get the little.
Oh, you think it looks
like backup lights
in the center. Yeah, that's where
yeah.
The lights. So they're probably little. It's some sort of like faux diffuser back there or actual diffuser. But I mean, come on, Civic Hatch right there. That looks like a Civic Hatch to me.
It's cool.
Yeah.
I'll buy it. So, I'll take it over the Mitsubishi.
I think everybody would.
Yeah.
And this doesn't even have an engine.
Yeah. Let me see. Getting poked in the eye with a sharp stick or the Honda. I'll take the Honda. Yeah. So, all right. So let's move on then to questions. Anybody know anything about the 3-liter V6 EcoDiesel in the Grand Cherokee?
You know, this question comes up every single.
Well, week. I mean, do we know? I mean, they're asking any word on it getting in the Wrangler. Who knows? But do we know anything about the engine?
Nice.
It would be nice. It exists, but not here. But what did we learn about that engine? Because it just sort of came out last week.
Hang on a sec. I did a whole bunch of research. Somebody, you know, a friend of mine asked me, and I did a whole bunch of research on it. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. Well, we'll circle back to it then. We'll pick up another question, which is, do we know anything about the 50th anniversary Mustang? Which I'm going to say no.
Yeah, have they said anything yet about that?
No. My guess is that Ford has more stuff up its sleeve for the rest of the auto show season. They usually do something in New York, so I would expect them to also do something again this year in New York. Now, I have no idea if it's going to be a 50th anniversary Mustang or anything.
So let's circle back again. We're talking about the 3-liter diesel, Chrysler engine?
Yep.
Okay, the information I found, and don't hold me to this, it's made by VM Motori.
Yep, that's a Fiat.
A Fiat-owned manufacturer. Engine weighs 498 pounds, 60-degree even fire V6, compression ratio of 16.5 to 1.
It's kind of low for a diesel.
A compacted graphite iron casting engine block, which is lightweight, weighs about 159 pounds. Let's see, forged steel crankshaft, aluminum cylinder head, 4-valve per cylinder, dual overhead cam valve train, roller finger followers, and hydraulic lash adjustment. Horsepower ratings basically from 220 to 268, depending on what they're using it in, and torque from 369 to 421. And maximum engine speed is just under 5,000 RPM. Fuel system, last thing. Common rail direct injection. Turbochargers, electronically controlled variable geometry. So we know a little bit about it.
That is an expensive turbocharger with variable geometry like that. That means the vanes rotate.
Mm-hmm.
They're great, but they, wow.
And it's a water-cooled ball bearings on the turbocharger.
Well, it's a ball bearing turbo. It should last a while. All right, so there we go. That's all your information on the... We have no idea when it's coming
notes.
To the Wrangler. Stop asking. Stop asking. We've asked about it. They know that we want a diesel Wrangler, but if they're going to do it, they need to be able to sell it, not just like make us happy. Because car companies,
if you want it, go down to your dealer. Drop off a $5,000 check.
Get your friends to do the same. Yeah. Make sure you have lots and lots of friends.
At least 20,000 of them.
Yeah. At least 20,000.
And then maybe it will happen. So here's another question that's half in reality and half not. Our friend Lavelle, not to be too hard on Lavelle, because he's a very loyal listener and he writes in a lot, but I think he's off the mark here. He was surprisingly pleased with the new vet, other than the electronic parking brake. There's lots of sports cars starting to use that. Is it a real sports car if it doesn't have a manual parking brake? That's part one. Here. Part two is also he's noticed they brought back the Stingray name. He's guessing there will be a base Corvette, and is he crazy for thinking they showed the Stingray because the base vet has a V6 under the hood?
Stingray is the base vet.
Can I answer the manual parking brake thing?
Yes.
In the old days, I learned how to drive a car with a stick shift. The manual parking brake was used because you could use your right hand to hold the vehicle on a hill to prevent the vehicle from rolling back until you'd release the clutch enough to get the friction. Today, we have anti-hill rollback control, basically an ABS circuit. Will hold the vehicle still for 3 seconds until it rolls back. That pretty much eliminates the need to have a handbrake to hold the vehicle still. I'm not a big fan of the electronic parking brakes, but I'm trying to figure out another reason to have a manual parking brake if you're not going to use it to hold the vehicle still on a hill.
J-turns,
Brody's in the parking lot.
Hot pursuit.
Does it make it not a real sports car? No. It does take some manual control out of it. I was driving a press car the other day, and the brake light was on the dashboard, and first thought was, okay, the e-brake is still engaged. So I instinctively reached over to the right hand like you'd normally would do, would lift it and release it again, and it had a foot brake. And I'm thinking, okay, the way foot brakes work these days is you push down, you're going to push all the way down, and then push it again to release it, and that's not something you could do on the freeway anymore. So I do miss the manual hand brakes once in a while.
You can do that on the freeway. You just gotta sort of
not in LA. Maybe where you live, where you don't have other cars in the freeway.
Wait, but in LA, like you can do that all day in LA because it's like you're just sitting in traffic. So you start playing with it. No, I mean it's not. First of all, it's a parking brake, right? So it's not an emergency brake. I've never had any success stopping a car with the parking brake other than it'll cook the you downshift first, you get it slowed down, and then the manual brake works kind of okay. I don't know.
Oh, I got something cool for you guys. If either of you have press cars, manufacturers, everybody shut your ears, but if you have press cars with an electronic parking brake, do you know what happens when you pull it on the freeway?
Nothing.
No, it slows you down. The last one I tried was a Jaguar, and it does slow you down.
On most European cars, what it'll do is it'll basically enact the electronic ABS until the vehicle comes down to like the last 2 or 3 miles an hour. Then it'll lock the rear wheels. So it does do a panic stop. Depending on the automaker, though. Every automaker is. So it's a good experiment.
Okay, I'll have to try that. What if the braking system isn't functioning, where then you rely on a mechanical braking system like the old pull cables?
And that's the problem with the electronic parking brake. You don't have a manual pull cable.
Hmm. So then that's something that they're probably going to have to work out at some point.
And I'll give you one more horror story really quick. My wife's X5, the servo broke on her electronic parking brake, and she couldn't go anywhere. And they couldn't even tow the vehicle up onto the flatbed because all four wheels were locked. So I was able to call roadside assistance and learn that there is an emergency release buried underneath in the wheel well in the back trunk to break the cable free.
Yeah, or you could just set it on fire and burn it to the ground, because if my car did that, that's what I'd want to do to it.
I got tons of horror stories.
Okay, give us another one.
Another one is a Volvo XC90. Wife pulled into the parking lot and turned the wheel all to the left, pulled in the parking lot, and then the ignition lock broke.
Oh, jeez.
So here's the wheel is turned like 40 degrees to the left. And, so she calls me and says, hey, I can't turn the key. I can't turn the steering wheel. I said, come on, everyone knows you just, you turn real hard on the steering wheel, then turn the key. And she said, no, no, no. And the tumbler had shattered inside the ignition. And imagine trying to tow something up onto the flatbed with the steering wheel turned like 40 or 50 degrees. So
that really sucks. And that's not easy to fix either.
No. That was a 2-week in the shop delay.
Was this a Volvo that you owned?
Yeah, XC90.
Yeah. Do you ever want to own another Volvo?
Not going there.
All right. Well, I think we're all.
Remember, I said I would take the Golf R over the Polestar.
Yeah, but that's just because it's a better car, right? Mm. Volkswagens never break.
No, all right. They just need love.
Well, fine. Speaking of giving car love, let's get to a nuts and bolts question since we're all sort of nuts and bolts people. Modern turbocharged engines and synthetic oil, are there things you would do differently than with gas engines and operating and maintaining them? Is letting the engine cool before shutting down a thing of the past? What's the best way to get more MPG? Low revs with some boost or high revs with less boost?
In the old days, I've got an old turbo car that you actually have to let it cool down, you know, after you run it really, really hard.
Yeah.
But today the bearings are, like we just heard a few minutes ago, they're water cooled. They're much better bearings. And, a lot of the cars, will self cool. They'll self pump the oil for a few minutes after the vehicle's been shut down anyway.
Which is like, is that generally like BMWs and Porsches?
Or? Yeah. BMWs, Audis, things like that. But I also would bet the Fiat Chrysler engine is going to do the same thing just for longevity. You know, that's what goes out first in the turbos. The vanes don't shatter, the casing doesn't explode, but the bearings go out.
Yeah, the bearings tend to wear, the seals, and either of those is affected by heat. I have two turbocharged cars. I generally run synthetic oil, and I don't beat on them the last mile or two. So by the time I get home, the turbo is not glowing red hot.
Right. Synthetic oil can handle a lot more heat.
Yeah.
It's not going to turn to sludge. Service intervals, the oil's a lot better than it was 5 or 10 years ago. It doesn't break down. It's got a lot more antioxidant properties, things like that. But
I mean, the safest thing to do is just go by what the automaker says. I mean, they know their engine the best. I mean, our Escape, they said to do 7,500-mile intervals.
Does that make you nervous?
I mean, that's, yeah. Like,
really?
I've always been, you know, not the 3,000-mile guy, but, you know, it's always been around there. I do a lot of driving, too, so it wears out the oil faster, I guess. But they drain the oil at, it's like 7,600 miles, and it was much, much better than I could have ever imagined it being. I mean, it still had the light brown. Yeah. It wasn't even close to being black yet.
Yeah, but you can't look at the color oil anymore. You know, the oil's gonna turn color pretty quickly. I've been using Blackstone Laboratories. We're not plugging them, but
for
oil analysis, and it's amazing how good the oil is, either in, you know, after 7 or 8 or 9 or 10,000 miles on it. Engines are so much better. The rings seat so much better than they used to. And we're talking an 80s car. You're still going to be stuck with 3,000 or 4,000 mile oil changes. But a brand new 2012, 2013 model, just much tighter tolerances.
I posit there are 2005 or 6 model cars that they're probably with 100,000 miles, mm-hmm. would have had maybe 3 oil changes at the most. Mm-hmm. I very rarely change the oil in my car, just because I go by the bigger chunk theory, right? So, if the engine blows up, it's a big chunk, therefore it's easy to change and it's an opportunity to upgrade.
Oh, man.
Don't follow this practice in your own life, but just generally, I just change it when it starts to look real filthy. And then
same
again,
with your, same with your clothing, right?
Yes. Socks, especially. My car sits a lot, so it's not sitting much lately, but generally, like, I don't drive it enough to really change the oil maybe once a year. I should change it.
But Dan, you bring up another good point. Is you know, my oil change is very different than Dan's or Jeff's. You know, my cars are garaged. I'm in Southern California, so it's warm. You know, if your car is parked outside, you're going to get a lot of condensation inside the crankcase, inside the engine overnight. And you do frequent short trips. That's very different than someone who lives in a warmer climate who's commuting 60 miles each way to work, where the engine's getting fully warmed up every single day.
Right.
And you know, it's just, you know, so it's a, you know. You know, I agree with Jeff. Follow the owner's manual's recommendations, and then adjust accordingly to your own lifestyle.
Yeah. See, and my thing is, like, I'm not one of those guys that, like, starts it up to charge up the battery and, you know, keep it limber. It's like, no. If you're not going to drive it, don't run it. Don't let it sit there and idle, because that's worse for it. You get all that crap in the oil, and it gets, like, just up to operating temperature, and then you shut it off. You're like, oh, it's up to temp, and then you shut it off, and you get a bunch of water in there, and acid, and rust. And so just leave it off. Drive it once a week, and drive it 50, 60 miles, and that's what I would do.
I think the consumers, though, the confusing thing is the oil change shops are still pushing 3,000 miles.
Yeah. Because they want to make money, and it's a bunch of crap. Yeah,
of course, but when – because everyone hates dealerships. So if the automaker's saying 7,500 miles, and then – Jim Bob's oil change says, oh yeah, bring it in at $3,000.
Yeah.
They're more likely to do that. I actually going the first oil change and the first oil change was done at 7,600 on our car. I was always in the mindset, you know, you do it a little bit early just right. to, you know, break in the engine. I took it there at 5,000 miles. They didn't even, they said, we'll change your oil, but you don't need it. So, I mean, it just shows that how far engines have come, that a dealership's pretty much just saying, let it ride.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't really need to, like, seat the rings like you used to and all that stuff. Like, they're generally, like, we get press cars, right? And some of them have, like, 1,000 miles on it. That doesn't right. stop you from taking it out and beating it mercilessly, does it?
No, even less. But, like, I'm going to go try some e-brake things in a little bit anyway. But, like you said, the... You know, for our listeners, keep in mind the manufacturers write those oil changes. Those guys are putting their money where their mouth is. They're buying you a new engine if it's Hyundai at 99,000 miles. You know, they wouldn't be risking it if your engine was going to, you know, grenade with 10,000 mile oil changes.
Yeah, and to the fuel economy question, I think anytime you enter boost, you're going to be triggering extra enrichment. So if you want to maximize your fuel economy on a turbocharged car, stay out of boost.
Correct.
Which means they drive like crap
right.
Because they are designed to go into boost at certain points. You may find that, like, on a modern turbo car with higher compression, tipping in, like, if you had a boost gauge, because a lot of cars now don't, but if you had a boost gauge, you'd see, like, you get, like, 4 or 5 PSI max most of the time. It's really only when you put your foot down that you'll get the full, like, 14 or 18 PSI that it'll generate. So, yeah, but just generally not driving like a monkey is probably the best way to get some fuel economy out of it. Low revs, like, if you're gonna hit low revs and then really squeeze the throttle, you're gonna get a lot more boost, and that's gonna kill your fuel economy. So you gotta find that balance where you can probably use a few PSI so that you're not horribly dangerous and still get good fuel economy. I don't know, like, with a non-turbo engine, you want to shift up early and you know, again, put your foot down as far as you can without triggering extra enrichment. Like, you don't want to go wide open because that's going to just make it go as rich as it can at that point. But you're reducing pumping losses by opening the throttle as wide as possible. It's all physics and stuff.
Yeah, I'm far from a hypermiler, but I think I read it's a lot like the commercial jets. You use your high throttle, you know, to get up to speed as quickly as possible, and then just cruise. And that's the whole idea with, you know, commercial jets. They want to use lots of power to climb to altitude and then use this super efficient cruise as long as possible. I think the same thing with a turbocharged car. You know, don't floor it, but you know, use 60-70% throttle to get up to speed and then just back off.
Yeah, you know, that's what I do on ramps, and people think I drive like a jerk.
Because you are a jerk.
That's true, I am.
Thanks for saying it. I didn't want to say it.
Well, on that note, I think I'll let you two schmucks go to bed.
Go to bed. It's only 8:30 in the morning or at night.
In the morning? It's really? Are we calling it? We're
on where am I right now?
Singapore. All right. Well, that's been the Autoblog podcast for this week. We're still in auto show season, so there'll be a lot more interesting stuff that's coming up, and we will talk to you guys next week. Hit us up at podcast@autoblog.com. You can drop us comments, and I haven't checked out iTunes lately, but that's a good place to leave your thoughts, as long as they're good. If they're bad, send them directly to Zach Bowman, who will be back on the show soon. Next week, I think he's off driving something that he'll tell us about when he can. And so there, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks guys for coming on.
Thank you.